Good day, everyone. I am Rabbi Mordechai Becher.
And I am Yehoshua Karsh.
And welcome to Two Rabbis and a Podcast. I know the title of this podcast is not that imaginative, but it is accurate. It is accurate.
It is. It hits it right on the button. We did talk about people possibly sending in if they thought they had a better title for it. My brother Yaakov did send in a few suggestions, which they were, there was some clever options there. But so far, Two Rabbis and a Podcast just seems like it's what we are.
It fits. It fits.
Yeah. And we speak truth. We're speaking from a place of truth. And if that's what we are, that's what we are.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. That sounds good. So our subject for this week is Purim, which is coming up this Thursday night, Friday, in unwalled cities. And so that is a huge event, and it's not possible for us to ignore it. In fact, we want to talk a little bit about Purim. I have some little show and tell here. You're okay with
I'm
that?
Looking forward to it. I remember seeing you shared, a couple years ago, I spent Shabbos at your house. I was there for a wedding, my nephew's wedding in Passaic. And you had some of these artifacts, such as that thing.
This is the Cyrus cylinder. It's not the original. That's in the National Museum of Islamic Republic of Iran. It's in Tehran.
At least that's what Mordechai is telling people. This is not the original.
Not the original. It's cuneiform inscription. Cyrus was the king of the Persian Empire after the Iran-Iraq War, meaning Persia invades Babylon. There's a regime change. Shalmaneser is out. Cyrus is in. Cyrus is shockingly liberal. He, first of all, allows people freedom of religion. Second, as it says on this cylinder, he also allows people to return to the place from which they were exiled.
And this is all the empire, so wherever they're from, not just Jews.
Not just Jews. For the Jews, this was incredible, and we were able to go back to Israel and rebuild, start the rebuilding of the temple.
Approximately what year are we talking about? Or what years?
About 2,500 years ago, something like that.
Okay.
Give or take. There is some confusion regarding the years, length of exile.
Okay.
And part of that is, as there are historians who say that the Persian records are not really that precise. First of all, certain Persian kings would claim victories as their own when it was actually a different king who did it. Greek scribes would then record that as the victory of this king, where really he was just stealing the glory. In addition, there were kings with the same name, as happens in many countries. And in addition, there were sometimes governors of areas who called themselves kings, and the emperor was the king of kings. So because of all of this, there is confusion. Jewish tradition has about 164 what they call missing years.
Now, what you're specifically referring to is the time between the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, the first Beis HaMikdash, and what we then call, even a few years before that, what we call Golos Babel.
Well, yeah, also the destruction of that first temple is part, one of the dates under debate.
You're saying it was not 586 before the Common Era?
Well, exactly. I don't want to get into the nitty-gritty details, but I just do want to point out that it's not always clear that the Greek scribes who went to Persia and got the history, and the Persian scribes who wrote the history, was not quite what we think of when we think of historical accuracy or historical detail.
So you're addressing, just again to be clear, because let's say you went to day school, like many of us did, so we were told that there were 70 years of exile. We were told there's 70 years of exile. There was some question as when those 70 years begin, etc. But the number 70 is the key year. This is based on Nevuos, etc., that we would be in Bavel for, in this Golos for 70 years. There are those who suggest, based on the records, the historical record, if you're a historian looking back, that there it must have been over 200 years that that we were in this exile. In other words, when we go back, beginning during the time of Koresh, there's a little, there's some who go back, and then later on after the Purim story, more that go back. But so figuring out when that happened, when did people go back, is gets confusing.
It does.
When you look at Persian history.
Correct. And what I'm suggesting is that
they're not reliable, those Persians.
Not necessarily. So anyway,
I've said that a lot. When I read Persian history, I've always had that feeling.
Well, so anyway, people are familiar
and amazing. They were an amazing empire.
Oh, very
incredible
cool.
What they could do.
Yeah, absolutely. Postal service and everything.
They could get across that empire in days.
So what happens is, as we know, after Cyrus, there's a takeover, and the person who reigns now is Khashyarsh in Persian, Xerxes in Greek.
Everybody knows that, Khashyarsh.
Xerxes in Greek, and Ahasuerus in Hebrew. Ahasuerus, and the X in Greek is a Ch, in the Persian, Khashyarsh, Xerxes, Ahasuerus. And he has this, the Purim, the Megillah starts with this incredible feast in which he's celebrating, according to our sages, the demise of the Jewish people. And it says he had gold utensils, gold kalim, and different utensils. So sages tell us it was stuff from the temple, plus the Greek. So, but here is, this is known as a riton, R-H-Y-T-O-N, not R-I-G-H-T, on, right? And it was a traditional Persian drinking vessel. This is actually a small version.
Would you hold it up just a little higher, like elevate it? Just
This there didn't you have go. A base. This base is because I bought it, they put a base on.
Okay.
So, and this is also not actual gold.
Which he again has to say for insurance purposes. Previously, that was not the original.
No.
Cyrus cylinder, and this is not gold.
No, this is a copy of something in the British Museum. In any case, the original size was 1 liter to 1.5 liters of wine in these things.
So that's a wine cup.
It's a wine cup, 1 to 1.5 liters. And it was the custom, Herodotus and Strabo, Greek historians, and others, tell us that it was the custom of the Persians to drink vast amounts of wine at their meals. And there was actually a, I guess the butler in charge, who would sometimes subject people to forced drinking, which they'd be obligated to like skull these and finish it. And even if they'd, you know, faint or die or choke on it, et cetera, big deal. That was, unfortunately, one of the components. And it does.
So this was royal feasts or any feasts?
Almost any Persian feasts, the upper class feasts. And which type of. And also, the Greek historians tell us that one of the customs amongst the Persians was that they would make, if they made an important decision when they were sober, they'd reconsider it while drunk.
And which is the opposite of the Megillah.
And they considered, but if they made it when they were drinking, they would reconsider it when they were sober.
Okay.
But being drunk for a decision was an essential component of Persian decision-making, which is weird. Although we do that is to some degree done in the Australian Parliament as well. But in any case, as is evidenced by recent events. But anyway, one of the ideas probably was they felt that if they're intoxicated, then the gods have taken control. But in any case, it does throw light on the Megillah, because we see things revolve around drinking. You got this huge party. And by the way, it's interesting. It says, Hashtia kedat ein ones. The drinking was without force, as opposed to the regular parties where the butler could force you to drink till you die. right? This was a party where there was no force at all. And it's interesting, Esther is always inviting to drinking parties. That's one of the reasons we drink. But it's type of, anyway, there's a lot of interesting historical insights, which not to bore people with, but the parties, there are some who say that the party at the beginning was really a ploy by Ahasuerus. There were six families. In Persian history, we had these six powerful families, and they apparently installed Ahasuerus as the, or they installed the leader, and they were type of controlled him. Ahasuerus was attempting to usurp the power of the six, what is in the Megillah called Ro'ei Pnei HaMelech, those who could just come in and see the king. And the only, you don't see mention of them after, in the later parts of the Megillah, only at the beginning. Apparently they lost, when he had this huge meal, he invites all these people, everyone's now Ro'ei Pnei HaMelech.
So he is not a descendant of Koresh.
And apparently they gave him Vashti as his wife. She was supposed to be, like in one sentence it says, et Vashti HaMalka, and then when Vashti, when Rashi refuses to show up, it's Malka Vashti. So he saw her as Vashti HaMalka, Vashti who became a queen, but she saw herself as, I'm the queen, you can't tell me what to do. This was
part, she was royal. She was actually
she
royal.
She was of those six important families who installed her, hoping that that he'd be a puppet of her. So this whole event where he brings her in and to show her off, and which to some degree may have been planned by him. He knew she'd refuse so he could get rid of her. Then he installs someone who is from completely unknown family. He probably knew that Esther was Jewish because she was taken from the house of Mordechai. But she didn't say her family. He says so he could always legitimately tell people she was adopted. I don't even know her family. And indeed, this would remove the power from those people. And interestingly enough, there are seven, it says there are seven advisors in the Megillah, and the first six don't say anything about Vashti. It's the seventh, Memuchan, who says, yeah, get rid of her. So that was also part of it, and that seventh was now elevated. Chazal tell us he was Haman. So he's now becomes the prime minister. Those six families are out of the picture to some degree. He is now elevated. Vashti is out of the picture. So there's an entire regime change within the regime, like a power play, etc. A lot of political stuff going on. Anyway, Haman, one more artifact.
Yeah.
As we know, it's called Purim. Al Shem HaPur, the Pur is a goral. This is a replica. This is a Yale University Museum. Has what's called the Yahali Pur, which is a die that was used for fortune-telling, etc., in the time of the Persians. And this is actually, and it's called a Pur, like at the museum, it's like Pur, Yahali Pur. And this was literally a Persian dice of probably the same type of thing that Haman used, after which the festival is named. And there's cuneiform writing on this. It says not suitable for children under three. I'm pretty sure made in China.
So you're saying it wasn't a game, it was for divine.
Yeah, correct.
So you're showing us elements from artifacts that represent Persian culture, which appear in and are not just appear, they are hugely important. When it comes to the Purim story, in fact, the name Purim is named after that die.
And there's many, many details in the Megillah that indicate that the author or authors had intimate knowledge of what was going on in Persia. The customs.
So this is that question that many have asked me. I remember one time at a Purim Suda, it came up. I was already fairly inebriated when it came up, but remember prominently that question came to fore.
So it's very hard to prove everything, you know, but can't do that.
Right. But in other words, it does not appear in outside literature. This event does not appear in any Persian documents that from the outside or any other documents from the outside. The only, as far as you know, the only telling of this story is from the Megillah.
Correct. But we have circumstantial evidence. In other words, the intimate knowledge of Persian customs, and right. also just some fascinating stuff that came up in the 19th century. Delafoy, who was a
Persian?
No, actually a French archaeologist, did excavations in Persia, and he excavated the royal palace in Susa. That's called Susa, which is, of course, Shushan in Hebrew, and found there was a river that divided the fortress area from the rest of the city. Now, what's fascinating is in the Scroll of Esther, you have reference to Shushan HaBira and Shushan, Ha'ir Shushan, and Shushan HaBira. And the Al-Sheikh, one of our great commentaries, points out that he says Shushan HaBira was the fort. Bira in modern Hebrew is capital. That's actually not the source. The actual source is from the Persian Birta, which is a fortress. So there was the citadel or fortress of Shushan, and there's a river, and then you've got the city of Shushan. Apparently, the fortress of Shushan was the official government place. Most people did not go there. Yehudi, right? When it says Vayavor Mordechai, Mordechai passed over, Al-Sheikh says he passed over that river. So Delafoy in the 1800s, 19th century, excavated and pretty much confirmed the Al-Sheikh's commentary that there's this river and there's part which is the city, and then there's the palace or citadel of Shushan. It's very just interesting stuff like that comes up pretty often. And
so there are details that appear in the telling of the Purim story
right.
that would have required intimate knowledge of Persia at that time, not just knowledge of Persia. Like if I visited Iran today and wanted to write a story, I wouldn't know some of this information because you would have had to be from that time.
Correct.
To include that kind of information.
Exactly. Now, if you want to, anyone out there wants to look into this in greater depth, this is a fantastic book called Purim and the Persian Empire by Yehuda Landy, who...
Is he the one we knew?
The one we know from Itri.
How do you like that?
Rabbi Yehuda Landy, who was a student in Itri, the Landy family studied in Itri. They were all brilliant.
One of them is brilliant.
A rabbi in... Rabbi is not a great... He's a Rav and a Dayan and a Poisek in Givat Ze'ev HaChadash. My son-in-law davens at his shul pretty regularly. And brilliant. So this is about Purim and the Persian Empire with historical, archaeological, and geographic perspectives. Beautifully illustrated. And it's just wonderful book. Going through with, and Yehuda Landy was, aside from being a brilliant Torah scholar, also very, very well versed in Persian history and archaeology. And this is a book in which he goes through a lot of these details. He did not own the artifacts as I do, but not everyone can be a multi-billionaire and have priceless artifacts in their home.
Again, there is a disclaimer. What you saw.
We're not real. No,
we're not,
real.
Real.
No, I did visit Tehran.
The insurance that Mordechai would have to pay,
correct,
had they been real.
Yes. And although I did visit Tehran when the Shah was in power, but at that time when I was in Tehran, the Cyrus cylinder was in the British Museum in London. So obviously I could not have obtained it from there. Anyway.
One thing, you didn't mention what's on that Cyrus cylinder. What does it talk about?
The various proclamations that he made regarding the country and his administration.
Anything about the Jews on there?
Nothing specifically about the Jews, no.
Okay.
Yeah. And then also what's interesting to note that in Iran today, first of all, around the time of Purim, there is an ancient day of mourning for deaths that happened in past. And actually, it's interesting, the tomb of Mordechai and Esther, which is in Iran, and is a national, mo it's a protected monument because the government venerates the prophets of our Bible, etc., Islam. But there's been, for the past number of years, protests at that tomb by students who have been trying to get the protected status removed because they blame Mordechai and Esther for what they call the Persian Holocaust and the massacre by the Jews of tens of thousands of Persians at the time of the Purim story.
Are you kidding me?
I'm not kidding you. No, absolutely. This was actually in Reuters and in international press going back numerous number of years that there have been protests on a pretty regular basis at the tomb because of the Persian Holocaust, ignoring the fact that we were attacked. But that's just fascinating, just from the Persian perspective, Iranian perspective. You know, when
That's awesome. Yeah.
they think of Purim in that way, it's fascinating to me. This is
Yeah.
not it's not evidence, but the circumstantial proof, I think, is quite strong there. So
That
fascinating.
reminds me of a lawsuit a few decades ago. An Egyptian filed a suit, or was writing, hoping to file a suit against the Jews for the loot that was taken at the Exodus. And
Straight out of the Gemara, right.
right out of the Gemara.
And Alan Dershowitz offered to be the attorney for the Jewish people and countersue for the labor of thousands and thousands of people for hundreds of years with compound interest. He said we would own Egypt. Not that we'd want to, but we would.
Yeah.
So that did not happen.
So this reminds me sort of
It is. It's
that.
like it's a
Yeah.
similar, yeah. Absolutely similar,
Yeah.
very, very, very similar. And just
Do
to go,
Jews venerate that tomb?
yeah, actually, Jews go there and pray. You can actually, I'm sure there are charities that will you can sponsor rabbis and they'll go there. I don't know who these rabbis are, no idea. But yeah, people can go there. I know people have been there. It's in Hamadan. But I actually was in Tehran.
So that
I
wasn't a
was,
joke. You were there.
no, I was there, yeah. When I was about, must have been about 2 years before the Islamic Revolution, I went with a youth group from Australia to Israel. So at the time, we flew to Hong Kong. It was about 200 Australian teenagers. We flew to Hong Kong. We were in Hong Kong for Shabbat and a couple of day before and day after. That was quite an experience. And from Hong Kong, we took Air France to Tehran. We were in Tehran for the day. There was a hotel, kosher hotel, apparently Jewish-owned kosher hotel.
So what year would this have been? Like in the 70s, like the middle set?
Yeah. And we went to this hotel. We did a tour of the city, Imperial Monument. We went to a Jewish day school, a Jewish synagogue, as most synagogues are. And we walked around the marketplace there. It was beautiful. We had a great time. And 200 of us, some were wearing kippot. We had a good, nice time. And from Tehran Airport, we went to, which only sold pistachios and Persian carpets. And we went from there to Tel Aviv on El Al. This is like crazy, but that's the situation. And anyway, so behind me, I'm going to actually just. There you go. As you can see now, this is a painting by Rembrandt. Rembrandt had a lot of Jewish themes and biblical themes in his painting. He lived in a Jewish neighborhood of Amsterdam and actually used Jews as his models for many of his paintings. But here is a painting which is Haman contemplates his fate. Haman contemplates his fate. So the scent in the front is, I'm assuming this is Haman.
He's sort of a handsome guy.
I'm assuming that that's Mordechai.
Of course.
And I assume that's Achashverosh. And Here is Haman contemplating his fate. He is about to, as he's accused by Esther, I'm not sure why Mordecai is in the painting, but whatever. He's accused by Esther of trying to kill her, and here he is contemplating his fate. It's a great painting, and like many of Rembrandt's paintings, biblical theme. So there's one thing I want to correct, a major piece of misinformation, which I feel that if anyone listens to our podcast, just for this alone, it's worth listening to it. What is the traditional Jewish food on Purim?
Well, we're going to go to the Hamantaschen.
What did you say?
Are we drawn to the Hamantaschen?
Did you say Hamantaschen?
I am drawn to it like a soft, I believe the phrase is he threw him a softball. Or so, he lobbed a softball. That's the American pastime.
If you look in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, the Ramah, Rav Moshe Isserles, says it is customary to eat foods made of seeds on Purim. Poppy seed, sesame seed, seeds. Why is it customary to eat food of seeds? Because amongst the first Jews exiled to Persia was Daniel and his friends. So there's a cohort of Jewish youth sent probably from prestigious families who are now in Persia.
It was really Babylonia.
It was Babylonia at the time, right? And they're asked, the guy in charge, the king says, listen, these guys don't look too healthy. Fatten them up. Teach them our language. They're going to work for me. You know, Jews have a good reputation. They're intelligent. They're bright. We'll teach them our language. So it says that Daniel refuses. He and his friends refuse to eat the food of the king. This is not kosher. We're not going to eat it. We're not going to defile ourselves. And he says to the satrap, the guy in charge, he says, give us water and seeds and we'll survive on that. He says, are you kidding? If you guys lose weight, if you guys look terrible, the king's going to kill me and have my head. Daniel says, I'm telling you, give us a couple of weeks, you'll see we'll be fine. They ate seeds. So that heroism of Daniel, that he would refuse to eat the non-kosher food, that was the beginning of that. That was the very beginning of the Jewish exile to that area. So in commemoration of that, Rav Moshe Isserles says that on the festival of Babylon, Persia, and that exile, we eat seeds. So what has that got to do with this food? So in Jews do not eat just seeds. We're not going to sit there eating seeds, for heaven's sakes. We're going to take poppy seeds, mix them with like honey and raisins, etc. We're going to wrap it in
dough. That was before garinim.
Yes, we're going to wrap it in dough. We're going to bake it. We're going to sprinkle sugar on the top, etc. Right? We're going to, you know, upgrade the seeds. And since we have dough pockets of poppy seeds, in German, poppy seeds are mon and pockets are taschen. So we are eating Montaschen on Purim. Montaschen.
And at some point.
That's right.
Somebody, some marketing guy.
Well, according to the Gil Marx in the Encyclopedia of Jewish Food, it's a phenomenal book, highly recommended. Massive encyclopedia of Jewish food from all over the world, from throughout history. Fascinating stuff. He says at a certain point, maybe because it was in Italy, he says, people unfamiliar with the German just called it Hamantaschen. And then ex post facto, people came up with explanations of what it's got to do with Haman.
Where did the triangular shape? You're just saying the triangular shape was sort of how they made, it's just how it looked.
Well, yeah, well,
just how they made them.
Well, my wife, who makes excellent baker, so yes. When she made Hamantaschen, so what you do is you got the dough,
yeah.
Take a glass and you stamp out and you've got the circle.
Yeah.
You put the filling in the middle of the circle, you then wrap one, two, three.
Now you could have wrapped four.
It doesn't work so well. it works much better with three.
Uh-huh.
And because even small circles, you get three, and
Okay.
bingo, you've got now a triangle. So it was not because Haman had Spock ears, he was not a Vulcan. It was
But
not
what
because
about
he
that
had a
triangular hat?
tricorder.
The
Look at his hat.
triangular hat of Bonaparte. The
I don't know.
Bonaparte.
That's according to Rembrandt. That's what the hat looked like. That is not a three-cornered hat. I'm sorry. That is okay. Right. And so it wasn't his. I don't know. I don't know where the triangle comes from. I have a feeling it's just a convenient way to bake it.
Okay.
Either way, most of these explanations are ex post facto. At my home, I insisted upon my children calling it Montushan.
Did you actually have poppy seeds?
I personally like poppy seeds, but no
But
one
did you make
else.
sure to have it?
Yeah. But
You
no one else likes poppy seeds. So my wife
right.
doesn't make poppy seeds. No. So,
There is a new trend to have savory hamantaschen.
yes, where we had meat hamantaschen once.
Nice.
Those were pretty awesome. Excellent. Although my kids have developed eye problems because when I say montaschen and insist on it, they roll their eyes so much they've had.
But that's not the only reason they roll their eyes. It's
No,
not
there's
just that.
I give many.
Almost everything you say makes them roll their eyes.
That could be true. And of course, one of the things which brings joy to everyone
Is a Purim duck.
is no doubt
By the way, there's been questions.
the
The
Purim
Purim
duck.
duck, you know, when you're onto a hit, when you've got an idea that takes the world by storm, that people start just wanting to know about the Purim duck. They don't care about us anymore. So in the last podcast, you introduced everybody to the Purim duck.
Yes.
This is obviously a much more dramatic presentation of the Purim duck
He
than
did
the actual Purim duck.
insist on having
Right.
it larger
One
than
of
that.
the questions, there were several follow-up questions about the Purim duck. One of
Oh.
the questions is, why a duck? In other words, was there some kind of, did you find some kind of a deep connection between ducks and Purim, or did
I
you
assume you're
just
being sarcastic because the answer is it's just so obvious that whoever is asking that is just doing it in a cynical, sarcastic.
there's a lot of people asking.
I'm not going to respect that question of what the duck. I mean, to me, it's just so. I don't. I'm sorry. I don't think we should address that.
Okay, you're going to keep it hidden?
It's not hidden. It's just so obvious that I don't think even address. I think whoever asked the question is just being cynical and just pretty
So even after Purim, we'll call
much.
it the obfuscation duck, the denial duck, or the duck of obfuscation. When asked the direct question.
I think it's obvious. And for those of us who do, I know that you've been teaching a shiur in Daf Yomi for many
Yes.
years.
Yes.
Dafyomi.
Oh.
As in Daffy Duck.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
So they're
Oh,
obviously
it's way deeper.
that's one of the
But
many, many there are many
again, you're just pointing
Rabbazim.
us to an esoteric meaning. You're pointing us to a deeper meaning, as
That's
if
true.
there's something hidden
Well, look,
about
we're
this
speaking
stuff.
to a very general public. I don't know. There are people. I'm remember. You know, there are
I
certain
got
people
it.
not to speak about. I just got to remember one incident. We were sitting in Reb Moshe Shapiro's shiur. He was giving
Yes.
class.
Yes.
I don't remember the Masechta. It may have been Yevamos,
Yeah.
and we were in a room that opened up onto the courtyard.
Like the square, like a kind of
Yes,
square. Yeah.
the room that later on became the Beis HaMusar.
Yes.
And someone walked into the shir and sat down, someone who, an unknown person.
Right. An
I remember
outsider.
an outsider. And Reb Moshe Shapiro said, "Efshar lishtalet al hamatzav." Can someone
Which
take
none of
control?
us knew what this meant.
But one did. Can
I'm
someone
saying
take control of the situation?
us
We
are
didn't
the
know. No.
American
Correct.
contingent,
One of his
did not.
Israeli students immediately got up, walked over to the guy, and said, "The Rav wants you to leave." And this guy said, "Oh, remember this? Like this guy
It
said,
was, I
Ani
don't
lo
remember.
mafriya, I'm not disturbing." And
I didn't say anything. I didn't do anything.
Reb Moshe said, I quote, "Etzem hitmatzut guf lo muzman hafra'ah." Which means the very existence of an uninvited person is a disturbance. And the guy said, okay, got up and left. I should point out, he waited to speak to Reb Moshe until the end of the class so he could still speak to him. And then Reb Moshe said to us, he said, I know people who are here, and I know that I can talk to you about things.
I seem to remember that it was one of those topics that you're only supposed to teach
correct
to students. It was a Dover Shabbat Erev.
You're aware. And he was not prepared to teach with someone who he does not know.
Yeah. No one to teach somebody. So,
yeah. That was like, I just remember feeling so bad for that guy. But the statement of Reb Moshe, etzem hitmatz ut guf lo muzman hafra. The very existence, unbelievable. So anyway, in as much as that, so I'm afraid that Rabbi Kash and I cannot go into the true inner depths of the Purim duck in such a public forum.
The hidden depths and things like that, they might come up later in our discussion of the themes of Purim.
They may.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
But anybody, as Rabbi Becher was hinting to you, follow the duck. The next step is obviously Daffy Duck, Daffy Duck. So just keep on going there. Keep on following that lead. You're going to get to the depth of it. Just don't let up.
And of course, as we know, Duff is connected to the Megillah intrinsically.
Yes.
We are told, the Gemara in Sanhedrin tells us that, who was it that found a board from the Tevas Noach? It was Sancheriv, was it?
Somebody.
It was Radan. And that later on became, I believe, the plank, the wood upon which Haman was hanged. Haman and his sons were hanged on this plank from the Ark of Noah. Yeah. And Reb Moshe Shapiro did discuss that at one point. But okay. So
once again, the connection is obvious.
Yes. Yeah. And exactly.
Yeah.
And did you have anything to add about Megillah, or we should,
I'm glad we're getting a chance to talk about some of these things. At the same time, we are acknowledging that a historical study of this is challenging. But I think you've given us first of all, you Yehuda Landy's book, which you've suggested people read, and also you've given us some elements of the Megillah which suggest familiarity with Persia of that time and the customs of Persia of that time, which would suggest that whoever is actually writing it is, you know, must have been from around that time, because they're knowledgeable of details. That this is something that Paul Johnson, in the History of the Jews, he makes this argument about the Torah, that there are all sorts of elements in the narrative parts of the Torah, like even in Bereishis, which you would have had to be from that time to know those elements. If you wrote about it 1,000 years later or 2,000 years later, as let's say, if you were writing about it 1,000 years after Avraham, you wouldn't have known these details, which were culturally significant in that time, because they would have been long lost. And we only know about them because archaeological finds in places like Nuzi, in Mesopotamia in general, mm-hmm. have verified some of the most, you know, like particular details of some of the stories of Avram's life and et cetera. You know, even Paul Johnson in his History of the Jews suggests that they suggest that these stories had to have been told by people from that time.
Yeah. If you want to see an excellent book about this, it's a little old, but it's Leah Bronner, Aleha HaShalom, who is an archaeologist from South Africa originally, but moved to Los Angeles and has a book called Biblical Personalities and Archaeology. She makes some very strong arguments, similar to what you mentioned from Paul Johnson. And I've just got the pyramid background here because Pesach is coming up in little. So we're going to be discussing some of the issues of Passover. We should do a podcast about.
I agree. And you were there?
Yeah, I took that photo actually. But yeah. There's the Sphinx.
I can, it looks like models from your desk.
I don't have the real pyramid in my backyard now. Okay. All right.
Before we wrap up, the names Mordecai and Esther.
Yeah.
There are those who point out that they have non-Jewish origins. There are some who suggest that.
Almost certainly. Keep in mind, people had multiple names. People were known by multiple names. Yitro, the sages tell us, had seven names. He was known as Chovav, known as Yitro. And in the case of Yitro, each names may have been pertaining to different periods of his life. Moshe had a number of different names. And people can sometimes be known as one name, just like look at nowadays. Right? There are people who have their passport name and their Jewish name.
I've never heard of it.
Guy might be called up to the Torah as Pinchas, and on his passport it's Paul. He's called up to the Torah as Mordechai. On his passport, it's Morton. Right. So in the case of someone who was in the Persian court, who was involved with them, it could be, we know that the Talmud tells us that Mordechai had other names.
But even the name Mordechai, I'm saying, the name Mordechai and then
connected to Marduk. Yes. Marduk, and Ishtar for Esther, right? And there's reason for that. There's a wonderful book by Avraham Korman. You've heard of Avraham Korman?
I have heard of him. I'm sure you know him.
Passed away in Israel in 1991, and has got a fantastic commentary on the Megillah. So one of the things he points out is that first of all, Kohut points out in the Orach HaShalem that the meaning of Mordechai in ancient Persian was a short man. I don't know. The sages tell us that another one of his names was Petachia. And then they also learn from, so we don't know. There was also, there were people who had names, for example, Moradach Baladan, Ben Baladan, king of Bavel.
Right.
So, it may be that these names were used in this way. And Esther, in the Megillah, she is already called Hadassah. And we know from the Gemara, there's discussion. What was her actual name? What was her Persian name? Maybe her real name was Hadassah. The other name was Esther. And it's interesting. Historically, there are those who say that the word Istar in Persian is Istahar, which is actually the morning star. And fascinating that our sages tell us that the psalm, Lamnatzech al Ayeles Hashachar, a song
of Esther,
Istar, refers to none other than Esther.
Nice.
It's interesting. There are those who conjecture that the English star is related to the Persian Istahar, morning star, and hence Esther. So, there was certainly pagan gods who had those names, but what came first?
Got it.
And it's interesting they had these names. And that also is another flavor of the Persian context in which these people were, right? In the Megillah, we don't call them by their Hebrew names.
Right.
We use those names, even though our sages derive fascinating things. Mori Dachia, where it's hinted at in the Torah, right? Esther.
Hanochi, Aster, Aster.
So I refer people back to our podcast about literalism in the Medrash.
Yeah.
So that's something where to look at. But anyway, great book. Oh, you can't say that. Great.
So what's a book called?
It's called Megillat Esther Al Pi Techelet Avraham. By Avraham Korman.
Got it. And so he talks about those kind of issues.
And he explains the entire Megillah based on the real politics of Persia at the time and refers constantly to archaeology, history, and the Greeks and the Persian right. historians. It's fascinating. He was also a great Torah scholar, but very well versed in these other areas. Highly recommend it. And
not related to Harvey Korman from the Carol Burnett show, as far as we know.
Actually, I have no idea. Harvey Korman was Jewish.
Yeah, maybe it's possible he was. Yeah. Possibly was. I'd like to do a shout out for a great Purim book, which is the Esther You Thought, the Queen You Thought You Knew from Rabbi Foreman, which is just a great telling of the story, and very useful. And there's quite a few wonderful books out there. I'm glad that you were able to make those references, especially to those, because I know a lot of people have these questions and. And no, there are texts
for the Hebrew, those who read Hebrew, Megillat Esther Tehelet Avraham by Avraham Korman. And for those who read English, or even if you don't read English, but you can just look at
the pictures.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Purim in the Persian Empire. Phenomenal. Okay. It's been great.
Thank you.
And
have a wonderful Purim.
Have a great Purim, everyone. And if you like this, then please like it and subscribe and suggest to your friends.
Google Wire Duck, the clip from the Groucho Marx coconuts. Very important.
Yes.
And also
Duck is part of my
help you song. Unravel the deep secret of the Purim duck.
Okay. May the duck be with you. Okay.